Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Steve Potter, in for Don Marsh today. We begin today with a look at how the Earth is changing as a result of climate change. Louise Bradshaw is Director of Education at the St. Louis Zoo. Jack Fishman is a former researcher at NASA, currently Director of St. Louis University Center for Environmental Sciences and a Professor of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences. And we welcome you both to the program. Hi.
Good afternoon.
You're going to wonder why I'm asking you this, but did you happen to see the Oscars last night?
Oh, actually, I was up watching it last night, and I'm glad I did because I got to hear Leonardo DiCaprio give a very elegant speech about how we have to come together and care for the planet.
Yeah, how interesting that he did that last night and you're here today. He said, in fact, that climate change is real. It's happening right now. And he said, quote, "It is the most urgent threat facing our species." Is that just the words of an actor to get headlines, or how accurate is that?
Unfortunately, it's more accurate than I think we want to admit, and I never really considered myself much of a climate scientist till I moved back here to St. Louis about 5 years ago, working in an environment where all we did was research on the atmosphere where I came from. I was sort of isolated from the way the public has been misled by a lot of stuff they hear on the radio, mostly. Basically a lot of information that is simply not true.
I would definitely echo that. You know, we have the great opportunity at the St. Louis Zoo to talk to a lot of people about environmental issues, and climate change really is huge. It is affecting and impacting literally all the animals we care so deeply about and their life in the wild. And it's also impacting people around the world really, really greatly. So we really like to focus folks on the problem, certainly, but also on the solutions. And I really like to echo what Leonardo said, and that is all coming together. We can, and we are, and we will.
Let me throw this out there. The intergovernmental panel on climate change forecasts a temperature rise of anywhere between 2.5 degrees to 10 degrees over the next century. Do you agree that that is accurate? And what does that really mean?
Well, there are a lot of people that are working on those numbers. I can't vouch for the accuracy of it, but what I can vouch for is that I know a lot of the people that are very actively involved in working on the climate problem. And this is a consensus. It's a consensus that is not made loosely with not a lot of very detailed studies of what's in the literature. And I have to believe that that's the way it is because I know these people. There's no reason that they should mislead anybody. And unfortunately, it's become much more political than it should have been.
How do you feel about that, Louise?
Well, it reminds me of when we all started focusing on problems of acid rain and the ozone hole and so forth. And, you know, there have been many times in our past as a nation and really as a globe that we've all come together, identified a problem, said, what can we do, how we can take care of this? And we've put in place the policies people have that support the positive solutions, support doing the right thing. So while data like that can be very daunting, it can certainly inspire fear, we really like to motivate people to say, this is really a great, you know, let's get together. Let's make the right things happen. It's really important for us that the future we have is as wonderful as the childhood I had growing up. I want my children and grandchildren to also have that beautiful future. So we got to get together, make a difference.
Yes, I remember when I was first learning to drive, they had just implemented the law that seatbelts were to be mandatory. And I remember the resistance to that government should not make such regulations. But, you know, we take it for granted now, and we need safety measures like that. Another very interesting part of this problem is there was a very concerted effort in the 1970s that cigarette smoking was not harmful to your health. And curiously enough, this same group of people that promoted that cigarette smoking was not harmful is now promoting that the climate is not in jeopardy. So there's a lot of information out there that is guided by other than scientific fact, and yet it's presented as scientific fact, but it is not.
And the Earth's not flat either, right?
That's true.
Okay. Let me throw that out there. I want to let our listeners know they're more than welcome to join us if they have a question or a comment about their topic, and I think they would. I think they would. Our number is 314-382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can email us at stlpublicradio.org, tweet us at STLOnAir, and you can find us on Facebook. Before we go any further, though, the Polar Bear Center, that's not what you call it, is it? Center?
The Polar Bear Point.
Polar Bear Point. When that opened last June, Alex Hoyer and Veronique LaCapra from our staff here went down and they talked to a gentleman by the name of Steve Bircher, who's the curator for mammals. And we just have a clip of he's kind of explaining what the center is. And after he does that, maybe you can say a little bit more about that, Louise. So this is Steve Bircher.
We're going to go into the, we call it the Interpretive Center. And in addition to seeing the bear in the underwater viewing pool, we'll have multiple interpretives in this building. We'll also have a monitor that you'll see that actually talks about what's happening to polar bears in the wild. And we actually are using the voices of people who live in Alaska.
There's two monitors here.
There are two monitors here. And we're doing something that's a little different than other exhibits here at the zoo. We actually traveled to Alaska and interviewed people who live in different communities there. We talked to children, students, we talked to adults, hunters, fishermen, people who are directly impacted with what's happening to polar bears' environment in the wild. They have lived with polar bears their entire lives. They know they're seeing these changes firsthand, and this is how we wanted to present this information to our visitors.
That's Steve Bircher at the St. Louis Zoo at Polar Bear Point. And you had a big event this weekend there.
We did. It was International Polar Bear Day, and so we were all so excited to celebrate it. It seemed like everybody in St. Louis was at the zoo this weekend on Saturday. And Cully, our wonderful 3-year-old 1,000-pound polar bear, really did a great job of delighting the crowds and showing off his wonderfulness. We also used it as a great opportunity to connect people with the messages about climate change. You love Kali so much. We all do here in St. Louis. So let's do the most that we can to help his cousins in the wild.
When we talk about climate change, we often hear about the polar bears. And, of course, you focus on it there. But it's more than polar bears.
It's a lot more than polar bears. So I could start talking about grevy zebras in northern Kenya and southern Ethiopia, who their population in the wild is somewhere around 2,000. They live in a really arid environment. And, you know, historically, and this is the case with a lot of endangered species, some of the challenges might have been hunting or poaching, habitat loss. But then when you add climate change and you add serious, significant droughts, it's really hard for those mom zebras who need to be right next to water when they've got their foals to really make it. Mm-hmm. I could go on about orangutans and the forests and fires in Indonesia and Asia. I could talk about Andean bears. You know, any mountain species has a great deal of challenge because their habitat is shrinking as the climate warms. And if you live on mountaintops, you don't really have much option for where to go next.
Mm-hmm. Right. And Jack, you concentrate more on the effects on such things as vegetation and crops.
Yeah, we've been doing research for the last several years on looking at the impact of global pollution on crops and other plants. Some research I had done earlier showed that you can actually see decrease in yields of certain crops by about 10%. For example, the soybean crop in the U.S. is about a $40 billion a year crop, and yet our satellite data that we analyzed along with the ground-level ozone data showed that you could impact yield by about 10%. So there's a direct effect that a lot of people just aren't aware of, that global change is more than just global warming or polar bears finding it difficult in certain habitats. So it really does sort of affect us a lot more than we realize, although the causes are indirect. Also very difficult to pin down. We learn more through more observations, and the whole science is expanding greatly.
We're talking about the impacts of climate change with Louise Bradshaw of the St. Louis Zoo and Jack Fishman of St. Louis University. Let's go to the phones. We've had a couple of callers. who have been holding on. Jack from St. Louis, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. It's actually Zach. Thanks for having me on. So I wanted to ask your guest from the zoo about the contradictions with the zoo's relationship with Peabody Energy, Peabody Coal, and her work with climate change. And, you know, if she would consider, you know, divesting or cutting ties with Peabody Energy in the zoo in the future.
Is this something you hear, Louise?
That certainly has been brought up. I will definitely say that that question is way above my pay grade. but I also am happy to say that Peabody does not impact our ability to talk about climate change. We are scientists. We are conservationists. We speak on behalf of the animals. We speak on behalf of our relationships with our colleagues who were super proud to have this relationship in Alaska that Steve Bircher mentioned and all around the world. So, you know, we're very, very comfortable being strong communicators and motivators and activators to get people to do what they can to really come together and have solutions happen.
Art has a question about climate change. I think it's how it relates to human activity. Hi, Art. You're on the air with Louise Bradshaw and Jack Fishman. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for taking the call. You know, everybody knows about the Brazil rainforest deforestation, but nobody seems to put any kind of a emphasis or points to Southeast Asia, where the mahogany forests are being decimated and burnt, and they're being replaced with coconut palm oil for cooking oil purposes for human consumption. Now, the thing of it is that you have differential transpiration rates between this type of a forest-covered ground or terra firma, and you have the differences in latent heat of vaporization and condensation, and the air flows in and off of that isthmus or off of that peninsula, off of those island chains down there, is making a change with respect to the vaporization of the liquid, of the vapor changes, and the Pacific currents. If I'm trying to say that the interrelationship of trying to support 23% over the carrying capacity of the terra firma or the earth, we're just putting too much demand as far as our creature comforts on what the earth can really provide without disturbing and upsetting the life cycle balance.
Thank you, Art.
Art, that was beautiful. And really, thank you for your words. Thank you for your focus on all parts of the globe. Specifically, you know, I'd like to kind of dig in a little bit. You mentioned the situation with cutting down forests in Asia and Africa. It happens in our hemisphere as well, in the southern part of our hemisphere, for palm oil. And one of the campaigns we have at the zoo is try to encourage people to look for sustainable sources of palm oil. Palm oil is in everything, soap, shampoo, you know, most of the crackers and cookies and seriously, just about everything. But you can look on the zoo's website and we can give you information to an app that'll help you choose sustainable sources of palm oil. We'd like to encourage everyone around the world to do sustainable forestry practices. As Art mentions very clearly, the interrelationships between all these ecosystems, land masses, you know, and, you know, energy flows, and it's really significantly impacting this really beautiful planet that we have.
I would like to thank Art for educating me, but he also highlights how complex the problem is insofar as secondary and tertiary effects of global warming. Again, it all sort of boils down to how greedy can society be, and the profit motive has to be secondary now to looking at basically the carbon balance of the atmosphere that, yes, it may not affect us in the next year, next decade, but it's certainly going to have a large effect on at least multi-decadal timescales or centuries down the road. And I think this is what the message is that Leonardo DiCaprio sort of said last night.
We'll be back with more comments and discussion about climate change. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. I'm Steve Potter, and today on St. Louis on the Air, we're discussing the impacts of climate change with Louise Bradshaw, Director of Education at the St. Louis Zoo, and with Jack Fishman, Professor in the Department of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at St. Louis University and Director of their Center for Environmental Sciences. And our number here, if you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, is 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can email us at stlpublicradio.org, tweet us at STL on Air, and you can find us on Facebook. Speaking of tweets, we just got one referring to Donald Trump. Rich Spencer says Trump certainly won't help climate change or anything else. Now that he brings that up, what are you hearing for the candidates on either side of how they are addressing climate change, if in fact they are?
Well, the question was asked when Bill Nye, the science guy, was here a few months ago and spoke at St. Louis U, and one of the students asked him, who do you support for president? And his words were, I don't want to be political, but make sure you don't support anybody who doesn't want to do something about climate change. So I hate to make it sound sort of black and white, but in general, the Republican candidates really don't seem to want to make it an issue, whereas both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders do recognize the importance of the problem that really is pervasive.
And I would say, again, just really we all have a civic responsibility to let our elected leaders and those who want to be elected know how we feel on these really important issues. Uh-huh. Please let them know.
We make the point that maybe some of the candidates aren't really addressing. What about the naysayers? It doesn't seem that too long ago when a lot of people in public life just sort of dismissed the whole thing. But that's obviously changing.
I think 2015 was a real turning point for that argument. And I think it is because of the Pope Francis's encyclical on climate, showing that climate is more than just a science issue. It's a moral obligation to try to do something about that. Now, a lot of people question, why does the Pope talk about such a thing as climate? But it's really not his words per se. He received advice from the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, and those are comprised of 80 very intelligent men and women, many Nobel laureates, who basically sort of advised him and put that document together. So I think it's pretty interesting that he's taken it to a whole higher level, that it's not just science, it's a moral obligation to care for our planet. We're the stewards of the planet. We must do the best we can to make sure that we leave it in at least as good a shape as it was given to us.
And it's interesting. I've seen breakdowns how climate change in the future might affect different parts of this country in different ways, whether it's Midwest, Northeast, Southwest, wherever it happens to be. And we have John on the line calling from Hannibal, and I believe he has a question as it relates to climate change in Missouri. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking the call. This morning I was walking and ran into someone, and we were talking how pleasant the weather was today. And the person started joking about climate change, and suggested that would be good for Missouri. I wonder what your guests think about a statement like that, that climate change would be good for Missouri.
I think there are many things that are missing in that statement, and one is really an understanding of, it'd be nice. Yeah, I'd love it to have the weather be exactly the way I wanted to when I walked outside, but the warmer things are in Missouri, the warmer things are, say, right now, we're already seeing a lot of things out of sync. One of the big things we're starting to see that's out of sync is pollinators pollinating really important food crops and crops that we really rely on for medicine, for industry, for all sorts of things. So we take advantage of all these natural systems that are out there for the things that we want, the things that we want to eat, for for the fruit, for the bread, for all sorts of things. Milk even, you know, the alfalfa is pollinated by pollinators. So we think that thinking is really problematic because it's kind of just thinking about oneself and not really thinking about all the interrelationships there are on this planet that allow us to basically be able to change the temperature anytime we want, put a coat on, go anywhere we want. We need to really be more mindful about our footprints.
To amplify a little bit on what Louise is saying is that these ecological systems have evolved over timescales of centuria and millennia. Unfortunately, the changes we're seeing in warming are occurring on much shorter timescales. And it's to the point now that it's been shown that many of the human processes and forcing functions that are guiding various things on this planet, like nitrification and warming of temperatures in the ocean, are beyond what the natural systems have been able to adapt to on such a short timescale. It's a really complex question. Hmm.
Jay has a question I think that Louise will address. He's calling from Baldwin. Hi, Jay. You're in St. Louis on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi, guys. First, there were two studies, I think, at least last week, one about sea level rise. It's saying it's an unprecedented sea level rise going back, you know, not just 100 years, like a lot of people that are skeptics about this say, well, those records don't go back that far. This goes back 1,000 years or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then also about coral reefs in more trouble. But for the lady from the zoo, perhaps you could explain a little better. I have a friend that always wants to fight about polar bears, and I always tell him, no, they're in trouble. The cubs can't swim indefinitely with no sea ice. But he goes, well, population studies in XYZ, maybe Canada, are staying there up in numbers. So I'd like your concise response to that. Thank you.
Sure. Happy to give you a hand with that. So the polar bear information is that there are a number of different populations of polar bears all around the North Pole. Some of those populations are well understood. We know really well what's happening with them, how many there should be, and so forth. And, of course, those are the ones that are furthest to the south, so it's easier for us to get there and easier for us to monitor. There's a few situations where people are starting to see polar bears come into human habitation in more numbers. So some people have reported that means the population increases. But the reality is these animals live over a huge expanse of space. It is really hard to track a white animal on a white environment. It's really hard to see. So places where we do have really good information, where folks are monitoring, one of the scientists that we help support through Polar Bears International, Dr. Tom Smith, is monitoring maternal dens. So the moms go to den, say in November, they come out Marchish. Well, he's monitoring what mom's condition is, how she looks when she goes into den, what's the cub's survival rate, when do they come out? And he's finding that they're going to den later and they're coming out earlier. Mom is not in the big, fat, healthy condition she needs to be in to survive months and months of giving birth and nursing the cubs and raising them up. So we're starting to see, and have been for a while, which is what led to polar bears being endangered, considered a threatened species. So it's really easy to pick one data point like your friend has and have it make – you know, that's the meaning for all of it. And you really need to go much deeper and look at all the science and look at all the information.
Jack, you're involved in something that's been around a few years, and I think it's a project that is expanding. Would you talk a little bit about the St. Louis Ozone Gardens?
Yes, we have a couple gardens now. The first one, the prototype one, is right in front of the planetarium in St. Louis. And basically, it's a visual demonstration of how background concentrations of ozone, which is my area of expertise, have increased considerably since the mid-20th century. So if you can find data that go back as much as 100 years, concentrations of background ozone, not in the urban areas but out in the background, have probably doubled or tripled, very consistent with what we see for carbon dioxide. So fossil fuel burning on the much larger scale is responsible for this. Laboratory studies conducted by the United States Department of Agriculture shows that if you exceed 40 parts per billion, which is not harmful for humans, but it is harmful to certain plants. And this is what we demonstrate in the ozone garden at these various locations around St. Louis.
Well, you know, one thing that comes to mind is this situation that we can control or reverse. Possibly we have a caller who's thinking about that, Mike from O'Fallon. Go ahead with your question, Mike.
There was some discussion earlier about the kind of time scales that we look at for climate change. They're on the order of geology, not anything that we are accustomed to in a normal human lifespan. So, I mean, what we're doing here is really damage. It's not climate change. So my question is really around, to what extent have we already set in motion dramatic events that aren't reversible at this point?
That really is a very big open question. You know, we're starting to see some significant tipping points. I'll talk about the Arctic sea ice, which has been, for the past 10 years, the Arctic sea ice has been smaller and smaller and smaller. You know, it grows as, you know, the globe gets colder in the wintertime and shrinks in the summertime and so forth. And just back to polar bears, that ice is really, really important for them to be able to hunt the seals that they rely on. So as that ice shrinks, what's that doing to the water underneath? And that's a dark surface versus a light surface. The light is absorbed by the dark water. That creates more warming. So we're starting to see all these different systems shift and change. We're seeing systems shift and change that have to do with the circulation of airflow and air patterns. You know, back to the question about our local weather. That have a lot of impact on local weather. So I'm sure, you know, there's a lot of information out there from people like Jack who've studied particular key issues and who can say, or key systems, and say, okay, I think we've hit a tipping point, or we may have hit a tipping point. But the one I know the most about is Arctic sea ice.
And I think it's confusing to even a lot of scientists when you look at and you hear statements like, well, it's been this warm before, there's been carbon dioxide levels this high in the past. That's true, but you have to go back millions of years to find those kinds of data. What's happened with the development of civilization, human beings have only been on this planet for about 160,000 years, and the last 20,000 years or so have been very conducive. It's called the Holocene, whereby climate's been relatively warm. It's been an interglacial period, but it's also been very stable. And what we're seeing now is that the stable, relatively warm temperatures where the human society has really, really blossomed and prospered, we're getting out of what a lot of people call that comfort zone of temperature that humans have never experienced. Yeah, maybe it happened during the time of formation of the planet, but we have to keep in mind that the timescales of human society development have never experienced these kinds of warming and sudden changes in the composition of the atmosphere like they did while everything was developing.
I guess in conclusion, I want to ask you, what do you think, what do most people not get about climate change? Or if there was one message that you could tell people, the bottom line, how would you sort of wrap things up? What frustrates you the most when you're talking to the public about climate change?
Well, so I'm an educator, which means we just keep going. We don't stop. And so frustration, that's more sometimes in the you know, public narrative or the media narrative. No offense. But really, talking to people, I get very inspired and I get really excited and heartened because I'm really lucky that most of the people I talk to and talk with are people who love animals and who love St. Louis and who really care very deeply and want to make a difference. And they just need encouragement. They need some focus. They need to know that there's a larger group working on this. We're really lucky to work, to live and work in this great town that has huge sustainability initiatives. And so it's a matter of, you know, getting on board and doing what you can. So it's frustrating if you spend too much time focusing on the negative. You know, it's there. We should all know it. But then let's move forward.
I think the bottom line is that the average person has to sort of change his attitude. When the Clean Air Act was passed in 1970, there was a lot of testimony before Congress saying that if we had to build automobiles that were less polluting, the U.S. auto industry would go out of business because it was the Japanese at that time that were coming in building the smaller, more efficient automobiles. Well, I think we need to adjust our mind frame by saying that, hey, this is the reality of the situation. We really need to be considerate about producing energy that does not come from fossil fuel. It's not going to happen easily. It may, in the short term, cost some jobs, but those jobs can be transformed into other jobs that can lead to a more prosperous and a cleaner environment. So it's got to start from the bottom up, and once people can start believing that they can do something to create less pollution, less carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, it'll eventually come around, just like it did with smaller cars, more efficient cars, and cleaner air.
And I'll just add, talk over you, but that it also needs to start from the middle and start from the top. So back to civic responsibility. If you care about issues, you let your elected leaders know. You let the corporations know. Let the people who are in charge. Be one of those people who's in charge. You know, organize your family, organize your community, your Girl Scout group, whatever it is. And it's really important to work at the policy level as well as the individual action level and community action level.
So climate change. Stay tuned, right? We've been talking with Louise Bradshaw, Director of Education at the St. Louis Zoo, and Jack Fishman, who is a professor there at St. Louis University and also the director of their Center for Environmental Sciences. Thanks for throwing a lot of light on this complicated and timely topic. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is St. Louis on the Air, St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.